Eric Schneider is nice enough to come in and sit down with me today, although we might have a few other special guests popping in throughout the episode. However, Eric, you came down.
Yes.
You're enjoying a Polish sausage.
Yes,
right
indeed.
Down there. You are at Johnny O's. And have you ever been to Johnny O's before?
I have not.
Are you disappointed? Because I heard you asking for a specific liquor that they do not carry. Probably one of the only liquors they don't carry here at Johnny O's. And what is the name of that?
Well, that's Malort. But I think they're going to order it. So next time I come, I can have a wonderful Polish and a little Malort to help cleanse the system.
It'll cleanse the system, all right. All right, enough of that. Now, you drink Malort on Friday night, Saturday mornings, whatever you call that, over at the Green Mill.
Correct.
You are running the, well, you're one of the members. Are you running it kind of?
I'm the front person.
Okay.
Because you can't have four people talking at once and four people deciding on what song.
Right.
So it was just kind of natural that I took it over.
So he's at the Green Mill every Friday night, Saturday morning, starting at what time? It's midnight?
1:30 to 3:30 a.m.
1:30 to 3:30 a.m.
Yes.
And it's an open jam session.
Yes.
So you get some young kids coming in?
We get everybody from kids to established pros. One night, Freddie Cole stopped by and sang. And it was wonderful, as you might imagine.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And you never know who's going to show up or what number of people. We could have five horn players. We could have zero. We could have four drummers or none. Or singers. Every week is different.
And then, of course, you took that gig because you enjoy staying up until 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, right? Because you don't, that's the life of a musician, right? You don't do anything else during the day.
I'm the world's squarest musician. If I haven't worked the night before, I'll get up at 6 or 7. Try to go to the gym.
Try?
Yeah.
Keyword.
Well, I go 4 or 5 days a week.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, jumping back to the Green Mill. Now, you started playing at a very young age.
Yes. Well, I started piano at 6.
Okay.
And I had a strict German teacher who really put me off. And then I pretty much put away piano and then took up clarinet in 5th grade. My dad always played a lot of Benny Goodman and Artie Shaw. And it just seemed like the right instrument.
Yeah. You're just drawn to it.
Yeah.
So throughout high school, now you went to high school at New Trier?
New Trier East.
New Trier East.
Yeah, back when
there
was
East and, East and West.
Well, there used to be an East and West. Now it's just all East and West is, I believe, the campus for freshmen.
Oh, okay. All right. And was the band program killer up there like it is now?
It was different. There was the East Band and the West Band, and the West Band got all the accolades. But I think we had more fun in the East Band.
Yeah, yeah. So it was actually like two high schools. Like full high schools, not
two separate and distinct high schools, yes.
Okay. So then from there, you ended up going to U of I?
No, I went to North Texas State University.
Oh, that's right.
I was a music ed major, and I gained about 30 pounds, and I became a great pinball player. World class.
Why did you gain 30 pounds?
Well, I was very miserable down there. North Texas State is a great music school, but what it had was not what I was looking for.
It's also in the middle of nowhere.
It's in Denton, Texas.
I know. I went there.
Okay. Oh,
as
that's
you
right.
know, yeah. So
dynamic Denton.
That's well, and I went in the 90s, and it was probably bustling compared to when you went in the 80s. Is that when you
was
went?
Was it dry in the
it
90s?
Was a dry heat, and it was a dry
no, I'm talking
area.
About was when I was there, there were no bars. It was all private clubs only.
Yeah, but you could join anytime you wanted.
Like I didn't drink.
You didn't?
I did not drink. I did not have my first drink till I was 21 plus, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah. And there are those who
and then you made up for it.
I'm trying. Speaking of which, I think I'll have a sip
Isn't
of this
a great
delicious
idea?
Goose Island Midway IPA.
Wow, look at that. It's a non-sponsored plug, but I might as well have one as well.
Well, after North Texas State, I eventually went to the U of I and got a degree in advertising.
Oh,
so,
you did?
Yeah, so this all comes naturally to
me.
Yeah.
But it was North Texas State then.
Right.
You left there because you couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah, it wasn't really what
who was
I was
down there then
for.
Who was the band director?
Good old what's his name? I can think of his I can
wasn't
Leon Breeden.
Leon, yeah, Breeden, yes. Yeah. Okay.
And no, it was good. It's a great music school, but their jazz band was more based on, let's say, the Woody, Stan, Maynard, where the U of I band was more based on Basie and Ellington. And that is more my style of music. That's the music I prefer to listen to and play. Plus, I had so many friends, and there are so many legends down in Champaign already, like Ron DeWar, Howie Smith, Jim McNeely, Charlie Brome, and Donnie Heitler, who just passed. So many great players at the U of I, and yeah. I was not a music major. As a matter of fact, my sophomore year, I went to Parkland Junior College because I was trying to get into the College of Communications, and one could not enter until one had completed sophomore standing. But I was able to play in one of the U of I jazz bands, not the number one
band.
And I spent many happy years. Some might say I was on the 6 or 7 year program, but that's not true.
But so you were getting an advertising degree down there.
But
you were playing in all the bands.
I was playing in the bands. I was working on weekends with bands that had a lot of nice people in them.
Yeah?
Yes.
Probably had way more time to actually practice because you were not in a jazz studies program because you didn't have to learn all this other stuff. You could just practice whatever you wanted to focus on. Is that kind of a good synopsis of that?
No.
I thought I was on to something.
I don't practice.
Oh, okay,
or I practice as little as possible.
Well, now. Even back then?
Even back then. No, I practiced enough to do my lessons. But I was, believe it or not, I loved classical saxophone. People think that's insane, but I love the discipline. I love the sound. And when I hear people who do it very well, I am in awe.
Yeah.
And I actually should do that because every once in a while I hear recordings and I hear where my technique is a little bit sloppy and there's no substitute for the scales and the etudes.
So did you that was part of your lessons that you were taking? It was classical lessons?
Oh, yeah.
So how'd you learn how to improvise?
I was born being able to improvise. I'm not kidding.
Perfect pitch or something?
No, I have very good relative pitch. Hmm. But I listened to a bunch of recordings when I was a kid, the stuff that my dad would play. And we had a 78 RPM player, and I had a stack of 78 RPMs, and I listened to them all the time. Our next-door neighbor was a piano teacher, and apparently at the age of 3 or 4, I could pick out melodies on the piano. Well, ultimately, I took the lessons when I was 6 or whatever, and the strict German teacher put me off. But I did take lessons from this other woman, who was our former neighbor, and she noticed that I loved to improvise, or at least not play the music as written. And she gave me this Boogie Woogie book, and that opened up a whole new world, and I could do the da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
And then I was able to improvise. I don't know if it was good, bad, or indifferent, but I've always been able to do that. If the song, to this day, if I don't have the music for Giant Steps, I can't play it. I just don't hear it. But if I can hear it, I can play it.
Mm.
And when I was 13, I sat in at the Showboat Sarias where they had jazz at noon. And
where was that?
Showboat Sarias was a riverboat that was in the Chicago River.
Oh, really?
And it had a lot of Dixieland. This is now going back to the 60s.
Was it set up, though, like a regular riverboat like you'd see in New Orleans or something?
I think it was stationary.
Okay.
But it was there, and they had jazz. And Friday they would have this thing called Jazz at Noon, which started in New York. The concept was they'd hire 3 or 4 professional musicians, and people on their lunch break would stop by and play.
Hmm.
And when I was 13, I did that. And I remember the song they called Dr. Jazz. And I was able to hear the chords and the progression. And
so you just naturally could hear this?
Yes.
It's amazing.
Well, I'm very fortunate.
Yeah.
Or better, I should have been a natural golfer. I would have made a lot more money.
Yeah, well, that's like, that's a whole other ball game, right?
But then I'd be, I wouldn't be... I think I'm too old for the super seniors now.
You could be in the 50 and over class.
Okay, that's one way of putting it.
Right?
No, but I will be 65 in August, and I think I'm playing better than ever, enjoying it as much as ever, and working as much as I ever have, which is ridiculous. I mean, Wednesday or Tuesday will be my only day off in about 10 days. And I've got some doubles and triples, and I don't know why. I'm not...
Why do you think that is? Do you think it's just because they don't know who you are?
Yes.
they haven't really gotten to know you yet?
No. I've got... apparently, people are very easily fooled.
I guess,
and,
I guess so.
I've got them buffaloed. And I work cheap.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah, sometimes I have to pay to play. No, I don't know why, but I play with different groups, different kinds of groups, and I love it. If I did the same kind of music with the same groups all the time, I don't think I'd enjoy it more. But the variety keeps me on my toes.
Well, and now getting back to kind of playing with the regular groups, right? When you got out of college and you moved up to Chicago, you started playing on Rush Street, I would imagine, and playing different places like that?
No, the impetus for my moving from Champaign was to work at Flaming Sally's, which was a Dixieland or traditional jazz room in the Blackstone Hotel, which years later became the Jazz Showcase.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a five-night-a-week gig, and I did that for about 10 or 11 months, and I was on vacation, and I got a call to join Earl Hines.
Didn't you go and sit in, or so Joe Siegel was telling me that he had you come and sit in somewhere or something, and he didn't know if you could play or not. Was it Sonny Stitt that you got on stage with or somebody?
Yes, but that had nothing to do with Earl Hines.
Oh, okay, all right.
Penny Tyler, who used to run along with her, I don't know if they were ever married, her boyfriend John Defoe, they ran Jazz at Noon in Chicago, and I used to play when I was in town. Sometimes I'd be paid, sometimes I'd go there just to hear the great musicians. They had Norm Murphy on trumpet, one of the greatest trumpet players you'll ever hear that nobody's ever heard of. Every note meant something, and after he finished playing a chorus, it was like he said it all. He wasn't notey. As a matter of fact, he played the fewest possible notes, but swung so hard, and they were so right. After he finished, it was like, what the hell am I supposed to do? It was Norm Murphy, Marty Gross, great mm-hmm. guitar player, and Bobby Wright, a wonderful, eccentric, kooky genius who knew practically every rag ever written yet, was a modern player, and he used to do Giant Steps ragtime style, which was...
Really?
Yeah. So Penny Tyler called me one day. She said, "Eric, I know you were there last week, but Earl Hines' drummer is going to be with us, and I understand Earl might be looking for a saxophone player. Why don't you come down and play with the drummer?" And I did, and the drummer recorded it, and sure enough, Earl was looking for a saxophone player, and Eddie Graham, the drummer who recorded that day, got in touch with Earl, who got in touch with me. I was on vacation when I got back. I called Earl. I sent him a tape or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I called him. He said, "Oh, yeah, I lost the tape, or I lost your number." He said, "Do you have a black suit and a tuxedo?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Do you have a passport?" "No." "Well, get one." And our first concert will be January, it's either 16 or 18, Royce Hall at UCLA. And that was wound up 4 years with Earl Hines, which was something.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't pay for that kind of experience. This is Earl Hines, who was playing with Louis, doing all that brilliant stuff in the 20s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was it like working with him?
It was an absolute gas. The only thing Earl was strict about was being on time, being in the uniform of the day. And we, at one time, we had like four suits, three different tux coats, and everybody had to carry a lot of luggage. Be on time, be in the uniform of the day, and don't play too much behind the singer.
Mm.
And other than that, he said, if you did that, he was happy.
Yeah.
And I remember one night I was playing and I thought I stunk. And maybe I did, maybe I didn't. I apologized to Earl. I said, "Man, I didn't have it tonight." He said, "Don't worry. We all have days like that. But thank you for apologizing." So I said, "Okay." So
and that was it.
Yeah.
So there wasn't any demands. I mean, what did you learn from somebody like that? That's a legend that you're touring with for 4 years.
What I learned from Earl: number one, be on time.
Mm-hmm.
Be in the uniform of the day or whatever you're supposed to wear that, and play music that it's appropriate. You know, Earl was at the forefront of bebop. His band had guys like Bird, Dizzy Gillespie, which is a pretty good start for bebop. But if I'm playing, let's say, with a gypsy jazz group, well, don't play too out of the element. If I'm playing with a trad group, don't be playing bebop. If I'm playing with a bebop or a more modern group, don't be trying to channel Sidney Bechet. Play what's appropriate. Don't play 85,000 choruses.
Mm-hmm.
And do your best. And if people don't think you suck, they'll call you back. And people keep calling me, and I'm very, very happy that they do.
So then you were with Basie after Father Hines.
Right.
Okay.
Well, how that happened is Earl...
Why did you leave?
Well, Earl's health was not getting better.
Mm.
And the start of the 82 tour kept on being pushed further and further away. In the interim, I got a call from a guy who wound up being a good friend of mine, Ed Crilly. Ed Crilly, who was the head of the Jazz Institute and a good friend of Basie, said, Basie's looking for a sax player. But what I didn't know is Crilly was with Basie on, there's some jazz crews on the QE2, I think it was, and Basie said, I'm looking for a saxophone player, and you have any ideas? And Ed said, I got just the guy. What was Eddie Johnson?
Oh.
And Ed said, no, man, I don't want to do it, but let me recommend Eric Schneider.
Yeah.
And Crilly called me, and we met for the first time. We met at Rick's Cafe, where I learned the Crilly Circle.
Crilly Circle?
Yeah, the Crilly Circle. I mean, I forget who you were hearing, but there were beverages, a lot of beverages. And every time Ed went at another round, he'd go like this. Well, the Crilly Circle happened many times that evening. Anyhow, I was going to join Basie at the end of a tour, do 3 nights, and then they were going to make the decision. And as it turns out, Basie, the band was in Vegas, and Basie was having problems with his legs, and he stuck around to get special treatment or something. Anyhow, we did the 3 gigs. One was in Chicago, one was in Springfield, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
Can't remember where the third was. And at the end of it, Sonny Cohn, Chicago's trumpet player, said to Bobby Plater, who was the straw boss, he said, what do you think? And Bobby said, yeah, he's good. Or something to the effect that he doesn't stink, which for Bobby was high praise. So based on that, I joined the band in 82, and I stayed through August of 83.
Okay. Is that when you're with the Basie band, when Basie's alive, is that like
world
tour? I mean, that's a world tour? Like you're everywhere, right?
Yeah.
It's all one-nighters or something? Or
mostly one-nighters. Yeah. Every once in a while we'd have 2 weeks, let's say at the Royal York in Toronto or the Fairmont in San Francisco. Or we do, let's say, a week in London. We do the Ella Oscar Basie tour, which Norman booked everybody. And over the course of a week or 10 days, it could be all 3 groups. Could be just Basie one night, just Ella one night, just Oscar, any combination. But we did that tour. We did that in St. Louis. And as a matter of fact, I once proposed marriage to Ella Fitzgerald.
Really?
On behalf of my father.
Oh, on behalf.
But she turned us both.
Oh, well, that stinks.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
we used to hang around with her, right? And whoever's on the band, like, you're just hanging, like, normal.
To some
kind
extent,
of a hang, right?
I don't have that much new to say to Ella or Sammy Davis or Tony Bennett. But if our paths did happen to cross and it was appropriate. Now, at the at Festival Hall in London, there's something called the Artist Bar, which is where the big donors and a lot of the artists hang mm-hmm. out. And I don't remember if it was that, if it was there, but I had happened to see Ella pretty much by herself, which I thought was unusual. And I came over and, you know, of course, gushed how much I loved her. And it was a thrill and an honor and a lifetime dream to play with her. And then I mentioned something about my father wanting to marry her, which would be news to my father and his wife, my stepmother, whom I love very yeah. much, by the way. And she said, no, I'm sorry, I can't cook. And I said, oh, Miss Fitzgerald, nobody would ask you to cook. And, you know, at that point, I'd taken enough of her time. Mm-hmm. And so I just, well, Miss Fitzgerald, well, to the guys in Basie, in the Basie's band, she was Sis.
Okay. But those are the guys that had been there for a while.
Yeah, I hadn't earned my stripes. To me, she was Miss Fitzgerald.
Right.
Although, you know, I have so many stories. One kind of leads into another. But I thank you, Miss Fitzgerald. You know, pleasure, honor working with you. I got in trouble at the backstage of Festival Hall. I met Norman Granz for the first time. And I tried to be polite and show respect. And I called him Mr. Granz. And, you know, nothing happened. And then Norman bought a round for everybody in the house. And he happened to be walking this way. I was walking. I said, thanks, Mr. Granz. For Christ's sake, call me Norman. Everybody calls me Norman. Okay, you know, I'm just trying to be polite.
Yeah, right.
But, but there were some times, for example, we did, it was Basie, Tony Bennett, and Rosie Clooney.
Hmm.
And we did 8 shows in some theater in the round in Long Island, and 8 in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. And after the 8th show, just as it happened, Tony, John Burr, his bass player, Nora, who was, we weren't married then, she was my fiancée, and me, and maybe one other person, we wound up, you know, just going to a bar and having a drink. And then that bar closed, and we went to another. And then at that point, it was last call. It was, I think it was a Sunday night. And we said, gee, you know, nobody, it wasn't a drunk thing. We're just having
yeah, just
a
hanging.
Nice,
you're hanging.
Nice
yeah.
talk, nice hang. Is there any place where we might be able to get a drink? And they said, well, go to the front desk. They might know. And we did. And as it turned out, there was a bar mitzvah reception in Mr. So-and-so's suite, and the liquor cart was still there. Now, I don't know who prevailed upon whom and what they said, but they called the guy up, and Mr. whatever,
yeah.
Tony Bennett and a couple of his friends would like to come by and offer their congratulations and perhaps toast your bar mitzvah. And, well, you know, I'm sure the guy's thinking, what the hell? But
you guys are crashing bar mitzvahs.
Yeah, well, this was maybe 12.
Right.
So we knocked on the door. The Mr. whoever he was got dressed. We had a cocktail, you know, cheers, and then we left.
So now you see Tony still, right? When he comes to Ravinia, you're sometimes on the band up
sometimes
there and stuff.
On the
Does
band,
he remember
yeah.
you?
Oh, of course not.
No.
Oh yeah, Tony. We're like this. I fly in his jet all the time.
Oh, is that right?
No, that's the line of another saxophone player.
Oh, darn.
No, I've seen Tony a couple times. I saw him in Beverly Hills. I don't know if he lived there, but the Basie band used to have gigs, and I had an uncle who lived in Beverly Hills. And no, we were playing Disneyland, and Basie was staying in Beverly Hills. Everybody else was staying at a hotel on Sunset Boulevard. I think it was in L.A. itself. And I don't know how I managed to invite myself to ride in Basie's limo, but I did. Sometimes I'd drive. Sometimes I'd drive to where the guys were staying, and I'd just go down in the bus with them.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple times I rode in Basie's limo. And Basie always sat in the front. And
with the driver?
Yeah, that's the way he wanted it.
Oh.
And
So Basie drove you to the gig.
Well, Basie wasn't driving.
No, but he was your assistant chauffeur.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. That's
yeah.
very
well,
nice
that's,
of you
that's,
to
well,
allow
that's
that.
One way of putting it. So Basie's valet, Mr. McGuire, we called him, and I were in the back seat. And McGuire was an old friend of Basie's. They were boyhood friends. He was even shorter than Basie, and he knew Basie from back when. And Mr. McGuire worked for, I guess he was valet for several well-to-do couples, and the couples died or he retired and he got bored, and he became Basie's valet. He didn't need the money, and this guy had, Mr. McGuire, had traveled more probably than Basie even. And to Basie, when everybody addressed Basie, unless you were Freddie Green, who could call him Bill, mm-hmm. or Mr. McGuire, who called him Bill, everybody else was Chief.
Okay.
Or Base. To me, I'm not familiar enough right. to call him Base. To me, he's Chief. Well, Mr. McGuire was the only one to say, Bill, you're acting like an asshole. And, you know, no, maybe Freddie Green could say that, but yeah. nobody else. Mr. McGuire said it, didn't even think about it.
Really?
Mr. McGuire was a great guy. He loved Hershey bars. And he's about this high, and not like Jimmy Rushing, but he enjoyed his groceries. And for Christmas, I found, somehow I got his address, and I got him the biggest Hershey bars I could find, sent it to him, and I think when the tour resumed, he thanked me, and, you know, awfully nice.
So. Yeah, yeah. Isn't that interesting, though, those guys, because you think about it, like Basie, right? There's only like a couple of guys in that group that have known him for a long enough time where they can see right through all his crap.
Yeah.
And they could just call him on it, but anybody else would be like, oh, man, and hold back, right?
Well, some of the guys, like Bill Hughes, I think joined in the 50s. Freddie Green, of course, was with him in the 30s.
And he was still in the band when you were in the band?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sonny Cohn and Eric Dixon joined, I think, in the 60s. There weren't that many people left who had been with Basie, let's say, from the 50s or 60s. Mm-hmm. Some from the 70s, some from the 80s. And again, I'm the new kid, and I should have been more respectful. I mean, I was so damn thrilled to be part of the Basie band. But, you know, sometimes if you're too nice of a guy, people will walk over you.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this in my mind. And so maybe some of the guys thought I was standoffish or, had an attitude.
Like a punk or something like that? Like a young punk?
Yeah.
Because you're probably the youngest one in the band, right?
I was among the youngest.
Okay.
Yeah. But, I mean, those those were the guys I didn't know that well in the band. For example, Booty Wood, he'd been with Hamp in the 40s, maybe 50s. He'd been with Ellington in the 70s, and he's with Basie. And his seat on the bus was across from mine. And, he knew how much I was just thrilled beyond. I mean, that had been a dream of mine to play with
sure,
the Basie
yeah.
band. And some of the old-timers did, but I think some of the younger guys really didn't know me that well, or maybe I was a jerk. I don't know. It's more than likely I was. Okay, you want another story?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. These are good.
So after the 3 days winding up in Chicago, oh, that reminds me of yet another story.
Another, all
yeah,
right.
Now you can tell, like, I'm an Altakaka, which is little old Jewish man. Everything reminds me of something else. So the band did the third gig, and they had like an unusual brown and an unusual blue suit. Well, I'm not a member of the band, so you know, for everybody else
it's during your tryout
right.
period, yeah.
So the third gig's at UIC, and I used to have a lot of clothes. I mean, I dress okay now, but back then. Man, I used to
you were the man, huh?
I yeah. had the clothes, the jewelry, and all that stuff. I had a suit the same color as the Basie band, except theirs was 100% poly. Mine was cotton or something. Anyhow, I hadn't worn it in several years, but I'm wearing it. Right before the start of the Basie gig at UIC, I bend over to get my music in order. Rip! The pants gave out right along the seam. So when I'm, you know, sometimes you solo and then you turn your back and, you know, walk back to your chair. Well, I kind of walked backwards. Anyhow, getting back to, so then I get the call to join the band, and then I still don't have the Basie suits, and that doesn't happen until we're in L.A.
Okay.
Because there was a place where they had these hideous 100% poly. It was a blue, we had a blue poly, a brown poly, poly tux, And ultimately, we had this beige-colored suit.
Is that because the polyester just, it's easier to...
I guess.
It doesn't wrinkle or something?
I guess.
Wow.
Yeah. So
you still have them?
No.
Got them packed up somewhere? No?
No. I think my wife, who has much better fashion sense than I do, said, toss them.
She was afraid if they stayed in the house, you might wear them again?
That's possible. I mean, the style wasn't that bad.
Okay.
But the colors and the material. So anyhow, I joined the band at the start of a tour. All tours start and end in New York.
Hmm.
So the band, they get you to New York. At, let's say at the end of the tour, then it's up to you to get back to your hometown.
Okay.
So the band met in New York, and then they were flying to somewhere in... It wasn't Detroit. It could have been in Ohio. So maybe they were busing. I forget the circumstances. But I met the band at so-and-so airport in Ohio. And I was there first because my flight got in before the bus or what. And there's a bus, and I'm kind of hanging out. And some guys, hi, I'm so-and-so. And I'm kind of sitting there waiting. You know, I don't know what the hell to do. Eric Dixon said, "New boy." Which is my, yes.
And you hadn't met Basie yet, right?
No.
You're right, okay.
Said, "New boy, let me show you your seat. This is where you will sit until you die or leave the band, whichever comes first." So, now the band flew everywhere. We were not.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
All right. Forget that bus stuff.
Yeah.
Unless the gig was, one gig was 300 miles or less from another, in which case it was just easier to take the bus. But so we would fly to the airport, and there'd be a Greyhound, and we'd have that until we had to get back to the airport.
Mm-hmm.
So there was not assigned seating, but each person sat in the same place. There were two sections of the bus. One was called the lounge section, which is the rear half, and the front was called the executive. And whenever there was a new person in the band, anybody had first crack at the new seat. As it turned out, I replaced Kenny Hing, who sat in the executive section. And you know, I had no problem. I was happy to be
sure,
on the bus.
Yeah, right.
But unlike, let's say, Ray Charles, where the back third of the bus was for Ray, even if he never was on it, each guy had two seats to himself.
Oh, okay. All right.
And, but right in back of me was Booty Wood, who, as I said, used to be with Hamp, then Ellington, then Basie. In back of me was Bobby Plater, who had been with Hamp for years, and then Basie. In front of Booty was Sonny Cohn.
Hmm.
Two seats in back of me was Eric Dixon. So, you know, these guys would be telling the stories, not all the time, because sometimes we'd get to the airport, and, you know, it's a 30-minute ride or to an hour, and, you know, they're just kind of chilling.
Yeah.
But sometimes when we did take a bus, then the stories would start. And that's when I was like...
Oh, yeah.
And...
You're getting jazz history, man.
Oh, that's man, like, yeah, from the people who made it.
Right, right.
And, again, that's...
And you were only in the band a short time, and you had that kind of an experience.
I was a little better than a year and a half.
Imagine those dudes that were in there for like 40 years, what they saw.
Oh, yeah. Well, you want to hear something? Freddie Green was not eligible for the Basie pension plan.
Why?
Because the Basie pension plan didn't come into effect until, I think, 82 or 3. And, you know, you have to be in there X amount of years, but nothing is retroactive.
Oh.
So Freddie Green was not eligible for the Basie, I don't know if it's pension or profit sharing.
Right.
But, yeah, kind of.
Why did you leave the band?
It was not my decision.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Kenny Hing, whom I replaced, decided he'd had enough of the road. And I guess the unwritten rule is if you leave of your own volition and want to come back, you can.
Oh.
Well, Kenny wanted to come back. I guess he wasn't doing as much as he thought he was. At least this is the story I understand.
Yeah.
And I heard that Kenny was going to come back and that my services would no longer be needed. And I'd gotten married 2 or 3 months earlier. And, you know, I'm not the smartest guy in the world. I'm waiting for you to say something.
I'm not disagreeing.
Okay. I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but even I can figure out that it's probably best for a marriage if you're not on the road 40, 45 weeks out
probably.
Of the year. Or, conversely, it could be the best thing for your marriage. But we were newlyweds. And
for your marriage specifically, that would not have been a very good idea.
No.
Okay.
And so...
So you ended up, you just came back to Chicago?
Yeah.
And
been working ever since. Knock on wood.
Yeah. Now, I would say, where can people find out more about where you're playing? But I don't believe your website's up and running right now. It's under construction?
Yes, it's under construction.
Under construction. So we know that he's going to be at the Green Mill Saturday mornings at 1:30 a.m. until 3:30 a.m.
Yes.
And then we know that he's going to pop up randomly throughout the week at Green Mill and Andy's. Are you doing a study at Andy's?
I am. I will be – I'm there practically every Monday, 5 to 8:30. Occasionally I have to take off. But I let Andy's know far enough in advance so you can go to their website.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not going to be at the mill, I don't think their website changes. So there's
no,
really
not
no
for
way.
The steadies. Yeah.
No. And winters, I'm there. Go to their website.
Fairly often.
What is this website thing? I've been hearing about that.
You know, it's that whole internet thing. It's a big fad.
It is. Yeah, just like rock and roll.
Exactly.
It'll never last.
It's never going to catch on. Keep your rotary phone. They're coming back. I wanted to come in because you're one of the people that I've played with the longest in town. Love hanging with you, and obviously have great stories. And you enjoy Goose Island.
And I enjoy the food at Johnny O's.
You do. You do.
And when this is over, that stuff's. I got that one, and I. Okay.
You got it.
Yeah.
I'm done. Absolutely.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you. And of course, if we don't see you somewhere this weekend, hopefully we will see you somewhere out on the sea.
And if we never see you, have a very nice life.